Welcome, and thank you for standing by. I'd like to inform all parties that your lines have been placed in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. Today's conference is also being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Brady Phillips. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Brady Phillips. I'm a public affairs officer with NOAA's Office of Communications. Thanks again for participating in this media call to discuss this year's hypoxic, or dead zone, as it's commonly called, in the Gulf of Mexico. In early June, NOAA and its partners issued a forecast calling for a very large dead zone. Our speakers today will update that initial forecast, provide the context for the factors that determined its final size, and discuss how the models and data are being used by the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force, also known as the Hypoxia Task Force, to monitor progress towards achieving nutrient reduction targets and to help address nutrients entering the Gulf from the Mississippi River watershed. During the call, about to begin shortly, we'll have three short presentations followed by a question-and-answer session. A copy of the press release announcing the findings was recently posted to NOAA's website at www.noaa.gov. If you scroll down to News and Features and then click the latest media releases, you can find it there. Our first presenter will be Dr. Nancy Rabelais, a research professor at Louisiana State University and the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and chief scientist on the hypoxia research crews, who will discuss the findings from that survey. Following Nancy, we'll have Dr. Steve Thur, director of NOAA's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science, also a member of the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force, who will talk about NOAA's role in funding hypoxia-related research and assessments in the Gulf. And our final speaker will be Bill Northey. He's the Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who's also a member of the task force, who will talk about the role of the task force in addressing nutrients into the Gulf. So we'll begin today with Nancy Rabelais from LSU. Nancy?
Okay, thank you very much for pulling this together, and thank you everybody who came to the conference. We just finished our research cruise for the 2019 mapping of the area of low oxygen in the Gulf of Mexico, commonly called the dead zone. And while NOAA and others predicted the largest ever dead zone this year, it actually turned out to be the eighth largest. And the size is 6,952 square miles. So it's not as large as we expected, given the high freshwater inflow from the Mississippi River, both in May and then again in an extended period up until the last few days, where it's now starting to drop. The best relationship with the size of the low oxygen and any factor that explains most of the variability is the nitrate load in May. And that's why there was a large area predicted, because we were in flood phase. This is the first year in a long time where the opening of the Bonnet Carey spillway to relieve the water level in the Mississippi River was opened two times. A lot of fresh water on the shelf, but not as much low oxygen as we expected. There are a couple of reasons for this. The first being Tropical Storm Barry, or Hurricane Barry at one point, that came across the Louisiana coast in the central and southwestern areas. The water, the waves, the winds generate waves, and the waves mix up the water, and and the low oxygen is alleviated in the bottom waters. And it takes a while for this to set back up. Now, we were just out a week later, and we had still a surprisingly large area of the almost 7,000 square miles, despite the mixing up of the water column by the storm. Now, from our research crews, it appears that not all of the stations were really mixed up. The large area of low oxygen that was documented by the NOAA vessel Oregon II in June there were remnants of that. And you could see that some of the areas closer to the river had reformed in the time period between their cruise and the cruise right before ours that went out that was also measuring some low oxygen. We started the Mississippi River to get the end member. We have a line of stations that zigzag the coast, and this year we went as far as west of Galveston, Texas. So it was large in extent compared to many other years, which we often don't get to map the whole thing just because we run out of time to get the ship back. But this year we were fortunate enough to be able to do the whole thing. Let's see. The area this year, however, is still 2.8 times greater than the environmental goal of the hypoxia task force, and other speakers will address that. A standard station is stopping at a location and putting a large conductivity temperature and depth unit over the side, which also measures dissolved oxygen and can take water samples. So at every station, we put this one over the side, and then we have a smaller one that we can take closer to the bottom because the larger unit does not like hitting the mud, and it's not allowed. And then we also collect water from the bottom. We look at nutrients, chlorophyll, the salinity, and many other things while we're out there. What you have in your press release is the size this year. You can see it looks like it's disjunct, but that's just a feature of the contouring program. It's actually a continuous band across the continental shelf from the Delta over to Galveston. And that's pretty much, we also put out a press release very recently along with NOAA's, and there's a little more information in there about the salinity. The fresh water was evident across most of the shelf. We very seldom got into anything that was 30 salinity units, which is very unusual for this time of the year because it's usually low flow on the Mississippi River in July and August. The evidence of chlorophyll as an indicator of phytoplankton, there was not much out there except just right next to the Mississippi River where we had salinities less than 5 in areas where we normally have about 20 or so. Let me see. The so Tropical Storm Barry definitely put it back, but it came back. The low oxygen came back, and I would predict that in 1 week from now, the area will be larger than it is right now, but we can only spend so much time on the water. I think that's about it. I could go on, and I don't need to. If there are any questions, then I can answer them during the question and answer period. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll now turn it over to Steve Thur.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dr. Steve Thur, and I'm the director of NOAA's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science. I am also NOAA's representative to the Hypoxia Task Force. So I'm going to touch on NOAA's particular role in hypoxia in the Northern Gulf. We have a responsibility to provide much of the coastal science to inform task force activities, and our role is really threefold. First, we fund and develop tools to predict the severity of the hypoxic zone and use those to issue forecasts. Second, we measure and fund the measurement of the magnitude and extent of the hypoxic zone each year. And third, we fund research on hypoxia, including model development to better understand how hypoxia affects living marine resources and human use of those resources. Since we started this, we have invested more than $46 million in science to support the management and address the hypoxic zone. So as Nancy said, the measurement of the hypoxic zone has occurred annually since 1985 and is a key metric to track progress towards the Hypoxia Task Force's long-term goal of reducing the size of the hypoxic zone below 5,000 square kilometers or approximately 1,900 square miles. The results of the monitoring crews can be impacted by a number of factors, such as the recent hurricane. So the hypoxia task force averages the measurement over a five-year time frame. The monitoring crew's results are also a valuable means of testing the accuracy of the suite of tools developed by NOAA and our partners that provide guidance on nutrient reduction targets throughout the Mississippi River watershed. In June of each year, as Nancy noted, NOAA generates an annual hypoxia forecast for the Gulf of Mexico. The forecast is derived from a suite of model runs based on nitrogen loading data provided to us by the U.S. Geological Survey and typical weather patterns during the time of year. The forecast has a good track record of predicting the size of the hypoxic zone under normal condition. For this year, NOAA forecast a very large hypoxic zone of 7,829 square miles. As Nancy said, the actual measured size ended up being significantly smaller than what was predicted. The Mississippi River flows were very high, setting multiple records, including several associated with the operation of the Bonnet Carey Spillway. The flow conditions this year were at the extreme end of the continuum of data that was used to develop the models. So by analyzing flow and nutrient concentration data, we'll learn more about how these particular types of conditions influence the hypoxic zone, and we may be able to improve future forecasts. Hurricane Barry, which formed and passed over the hypoxic zone just before the cruise, likely played a major role in mixing the water column and disrupting the hypoxia that had already formed. As Nancy said, hypoxia typically takes some time to reform after an event like Barry. Therefore, we can't state whether the measured size was the maximum extent of the hypoxic zone. Significant wind events like Hurricane Barry will affect it, the zone and our measurement of it, but these stochastic events can't be easily factored into our models. This highlights the need for improved ways of monitoring the Gulf in addition to the synoptic cruise that Nancy leads each year. A retrospective recreation of the entire hypoxia season is performed each fall and helps to characterize how well the snapshot measurement of the zone represented the hypoxia conditions for the entire year. It also serves as an evaluation of newer and more advanced models. This approach can explain how high winds, currents, increased and sustained river discharge during the survey cruise may have impacted the hypoxia measurement. Models of this type help the hypoxia task force consider the chronic nature of the hypoxic zone, answering the question how big was it and how, for how long, and to consider how much of the area of the Gulf was affected since the zone moves around. These types of spatial models are used to evaluate impacts to living marine resources as they estimate the spatial extent of hypoxia and how that is likely to impact the biological needs and life cycle of various marine organisms. NOAA has ongoing investments to better understand the long-term impacts, to incorporate this information into integrated models that connect upstream watershed activities with the downstream impacts to the coastal ecosystem. I'd like to acknowledge and thank Dr. Rabelais and her team for our long-term partnership and recognize both Dave Kidwell and Dr. Dave Scher of NOAA for their role in overseeing our hypoxia research activities. As I've discussed, NOAA's efforts are mainly focused on understanding the downstream impacts of the nutrients once they enter the Gulf from the vast Mississippi River watershed. Many of the activities of the Hypoxia Task Force are focused on trying to keep those nutrients from entering the Gulf in the first place. I'll turn it over to U.S. Department of Agriculture Undersecretary Bill Northey to speak about what other federal agencies and the states are doing to address excess nutrient loss in the watershed.
Thank you, Steve. This is Bill Northey at U.S. Department of Agriculture, Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation. So thanks to Steve and Nancy and Brady for starting us off here. I get a chance to be able to talk a little bit about the Hypoxia Task Force. As others have said, the longer title is Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force. I'm just going to call it the Hypoxia Task Force. That's what I know it as. And am also, along with Steve, a representative on that task force. I was actually in my previous role as Secretary of Agriculture in Iowa also on that task force for about 11 years and served the last few years as the state co-chair for that task force. So an overview of the task force, it is a collection of the federal agencies. We already talked about USGS, NOAA, USDA, the federal lead for that task force is Environmental Protection Agency. So David Ross, Assistant Secretary for the Office of Water, sits as a co-chair. There is a state co-chair as well that is right now the Secretary of Agriculture in out of Iowa. That's Mike Nagy, is that state co-chair. We have other federal agencies. I don't have that list in front of me now. I'm sure that is also listed, easy to find, but other federal agencies, the Corps of Engineers are usually there, several others that you imagine that have water responsibilities. In fact, we just had a gathering, actually, of the last few days of some of those partners around some drought concerns. We have the National Drought Forum the last few days here in Washington, D.C., so we were talking drought issues. Many of us also then talk about nutrient issues with the Hypoxia Task Force. The other part, an important part of the Hypoxia Task Force is are the states up and down the main stem and east into along the Ohio and Illinois River as well. A dozen states that have significant contributions of water and therefore nutrients that can impact that hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So it was determined by scientists that certainly that hypoxic zone is influenced significantly by the amount of nutrients that end up in the Gulf of Mexico, especially coming off of spring nutrient levels. We've also influenced the amount of wetlands in the Louisiana area, so some of those nutrients used to get captured in wetlands. Now there's an effort to kind of reestablish some of those wetlands as well. And then the hypoxic states, or the states that have an influence on the amount of nutrients, have a goal established by the Hypoxia Task Force to reduce the amount of nutrients by 45%, both phosphorus and nitrates that come down the Gulf or come down the Mississippi River. Each of those states are looking back and seeing what their contribution is, and then have various nutrient reduction plans for each of those states to figure out how they can decrease the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that are leaving their states. I'm most familiar, of course, with Iowa's because I was there when we were doing the plan for the state of Iowa. Each state's plan is a little different, often influenced by the state's nutrient reduction goals as well, whether it was around rivers or lakes in the state, certainly influenced by where the contributions came from, whether it came from cropland, whether it came from point sources, whether it came from pasture land. And so there's a focus on each of those states. As we've gone along, each state has kind of intensified the effort that they have brought to those nutrient reduction plans. Minnesota did some work around looking at buffer strips. In Iowa, we looked at kind of a broad-based nutrient strategy. In some of the other states, it was more focused on some of the lower basin states around rice. It was around irrigation water recapture and being able to not only at making sure you're as efficient as you can with that irrigation water, but capturing those nutrients as well that would have traveled with that irrigation water. And then other states looking at pasture land and phosphorus that could come from some of the surface water nutrients that could be lost. So the premise here is to bring the folks together, the states together, to be able to share and kind of hold each other accountable on the plans, develop a plan, talk about the contribution. Several states have looked at increasing the funding levels that they have for addressing nutrients. The federal partners coming together to make sure that we're all working together and coordinating with states, but also looking at what we're doing on a regulatory side. So Corps of Engineers is there to talk about permitting, EPA's there to talk about what they're doing around point sources, even nutrient trading. I know David Ross is very interested in being able to look at some market-based opportunities to address some pieces. We heard NOAA and the mention of USGS talk about monitoring to improving the science of understanding how nutrients are getting to the Gulf, what their reaction is, maybe even the interface between the freshwater and saltwater, and then just the improvement altogether of all of us working together so that as we have lots of pieces here at USGA, we have conservation programs, cost share programs, and we work with farmers. How are we coordinating with state conservation agencies? How are we partnering with some of the watershed projects that are out there? How are we implementing projects that include regional conservation partnership projects, other watershed-based projects, to leverage as much improvement in nutrients along with some of the other conservation criteria that are part of those plans. So it's a broad-based effort. I'm certainly glad to try and answer any questions about that, but long ways to go. This is a large watershed, a lot of nutrients that typically come in very small amounts from a large area, which makes it an especial challenge to try and get the net reduction that we need to be able to get at the Gulf of Mexico to get much closer to that goal. I'm glad to see the numbers are less than what the projection was. That does not mean that we've achieved a tremendous amount of success or gotten to where we need to be, but I see a lot of progress going on in engagement that offers the opportunity to scale up and continue to find some nutrient reductions over time. Even one small piece, cover crops, we see more and more cover crop engagement across the basin, although it's still a small number, that reduces the amount of nitrogen that gets lost out of farm fields, certainly reduces the erosion that can contribute phosphorus, but that also is a long way to go before we see the kind of coverage it's going to take to be able to get the kind of reduction that we can depend on to be able to reduce the size of that hypoxic zone in future years and in what may be different weather events in future times. So let me end there and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now take specific questions from the phone lines. And if you know you'd like to answer the question, please indicate so, or otherwise we'll figure it out. Calvin, can you please remind the participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first call, please? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. At this time, we will begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask the question, please press star, then one on your phone. Please ensure that your phone is unmuted and record your name at the prompt. Again, that is star one to ask the question. One moment, please, while the first question comes in. Our first question comes from Mark. Your line is open.
Okay, folks. Mark Schlesing with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. This year we have had the additional problem with not just the low oxygen dead zone off the coast, but also a huge amount of beaches closed, lake issues with also resulting from nutrient-derived algae blooms, in this case, blue-green algae and problems with that. It all leads to basically the same question. Here we are, almost 34 years after the first cruise, and there's very little difference in the size of the dead zone, very little difference in the amount of nutrients being carried downriver by the river. What is it going to take for the federal government to step in and start doing something about what is now a very serious issue? We've got fishermen in Louisiana and Mississippi both petitioning the federal government for money to help their deal with their losses this year. Anybody want to respond to that?
Hi, Mark. This is Steve Thur from NOAA. I can address part of what you asked about. So NOAA's role in addressing hypoxia and the upstream causes of that is dictated by a statute that covers harmful algal blooms and hypoxia, and it's a specific research statute. Our role and our authorities there are to fund a series of steps to understand the impacts. So I can't speak to what may be done in the upper watershed to address the nutrient loss issues that is ultimately fueling the algal blooms leading to the hypoxia, but with what has happened in Lake Pontchartrain and along the Mississippi shore, we have, with our other federal partners, mobilized both funding and technical assistance to look at the impacts from the opening of the Bonnie Carey spillway. So while that doesn't address what's going to take to ultimately stop the flow of nutrients, I hope it gives a little deeper understanding of NOAA's role. We're providing satellite imagery to our partners, including the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the EPA, and the USGS. That's tracking the harmful algal bloom. We have also provided funding for the testing of toxins being produced by those algae, and we are talking with our partners about the hypoxia event that is occurring to the east of what is typically measured by Nancy and her team.
Nancy, can I add on to the algal bloom? This is not just a Gulf of Mexico problem. There are toxic blue-green algal blooms up in the watershed, in ponds, reservoirs, and lakes. And there are also too high of nitrate level in drinking water. So the nutrient mitigation that might happen in the upper part of the watershed will only benefit that part of the watershed as well.
And Mark, this is Bill Northey. It's a great question, and actually we've got folks in all around the world looking at hypoxic zones that are a real challenge. This is an area, while we've known about it for a long time, I certainly feel like probably the first two-thirds of those years were in many ways we did not engage as well as was necessary, certainly, to be able to make significant improvements in nutrient reduction loss. I remember my first years on the hypoxia task force. There was a lot of conversation about how there were going to be large amounts of federal dollars and states were gathered to be able to spend that. It was determined after a while that that wasn't going to happen, and we needed state nutrient plans, and we needed to be able to see investments by states. We are seeing some of that. It's going to take a long time at the rate that we're seeing improvements, but I do believe that we're seeing some momentum that would suggest that we're making more progress now than we were in those early years of either the understanding of the hypoxia zone or certainly the engagement by the task force. We just saw Ohio make a large investment in the amount of dollars they're going to spend on water quality. Of course, a lot of that was focused on Western Lake Erie Basin, but they have a large area that water heads towards the Mississippi River and down as well. So we're seeing pieces of it. We also see some impact this year from the large flows from flooding. That picks up more nutrients and carries it down the river. It may dilute it in some cases a little bit, but it certainly carries large amounts of nutrients that can contribute towards the loading. And then we saw some additional impact of that fresh water on some of the fisheries there in the Gulf region. So I think this is a complex issue. We're not making progress as fast as we'd like it to be, but I think we're seeing better engagement, and this includes not only better engagement up the basin, both from non-point source areas, but from point source areas, but also in wetlands restructuring and rebuilding where we lost some of those wetlands or that natural filter in the Gulf area itself. Slow, it's expensive, it's going to take a long time, but I certainly feel like the momentum is in the right direction, even though I certainly don't have an endpoint that would suggest when things are going to have a massive improvement either.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Travis Lux. Your line is open.
Yeah, I guess Mark kind of asked the question that I was looking to get answered, but I have another question about the science of this stuff. So basically, there's just a ton of water and all of this flooding this year. If the nitrates are more dissolved in the water or more but less concentrated, rather, how does that impact on the kind of scientific level? How does that impact the development of the hypoxic conditions? Does it make it better or worse or anything?
This is Nancy. Despite all this fresh water, we still had higher nitrate concentrations than we normally do during the spring period and especially into the summer. So they were not all diluted away. And the best indicator of the size is going to be the total nitrate load, and that takes into account both the river discharge and the concentration of the nitrate. So it wasn't all diluted.
Okay. Operator, are there any more questions in the queue?
At this time, I'm showing no further questions. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your phone.
This is Nancy. I'd just like to offer another additional weather situation that occurred offshore this summer. We kept reading the marine forecast every day, and it said 1 foot or less. But we had swells of 3 to 4, 4 to 5, and even an occasional 6, because we were working in the area where that cold front had stalled out in the Gulf. And so that continued to contribute to wave mixing of the water column.
All right, and we do have a few questions that have come in. Mark Schlesstein from the Times-Picayune, your line is open.
Hey, it's Mark again, and just following up on my earlier question, can you guys, somebody there, address the Clean Water Act and why there's not a way of using the Clean Water Act to better regulate the nutrients in that are non-point?
I think we'd probably be best off if we had our EPA friends on here to be able to talk about that. I know there are certainly some guidelines around how the Clean Water Act does address water, including often it addresses drinking water standards rather than, non-point source, another piece. I'm way out of over my skis on this, so I'll let others try to address it, and certainly there would be other folks that and some legal proceedings from time to time that attempt to try and get at your question.
This is Steve from NOAA. Unfortunately, I cannot speak to Clean Water Act authorities. We have very little role in implementing that statute within NOAA, and I think I agree with Bill that question would best be referred to the EPA.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Haley Parker with the Homer Courier. Your line's open.
Hi, I'm Haley Parker with the Homer Courier. I was just wondering, with Hurricane Barry and the effect that it's had on the measured size of the dead zone, how well can this data actually be used when it comes to thinking about if, like, the reduction strategies are working and that sort of thing? How will this data be used moving forward?
This is Nancy. The goal is on a 5-year running average. What we measure.
Hello, Nancy. Are you there?
I think we lost her.
All right. Well, let's come back to that question. Or Steve, actually.
So this is Steve from NOAA. Perhaps I can provide a response, and we can have Nancy rejoin. We recognize the limitations of a cruise that spans roughly a single week in trying to measure a phenomenon that is both temporally and spatially variable. So the question is a good one, and the short answer is we don't know how accurate a measurement of the maximal extent we are getting with this roughly one-week cruise every year. That's one reason why the Hypoxia Task Force has decided to target a 5-year running average for its goal. However, as a science agency, we are looking at additional methods to measure that would give us a greater temporal coverage throughout the summer. A couple of years ago, we tested an unmanned autonomous underwater vehicle. At the time, the technology was not ready enough for it to be able to do what was needed, which is measure, among other things, dissolved oxygen content at the bottom. We are looking at funding additional research in addition to Nancy's ongoing cruise. In an ideal setting, technology would be such that we could put out one or more autonomous underwater vehicles for a longer duration to measure the hypoxic zone in addition to the cruise that Nancy leads each year. So we recognize this as a challenge. We're hopeful that the unmanned systems technology has advanced enough in the last 3 or 4 years, and we're looking at potentially investing in that research next fiscal year.
And Nancy, have you rejoined us?
Yeah, somebody probably jumped in and said that we measure progress with a 5-year running average, but it's still not enough.
Okay, great, thank you, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Karina with RMO. Your line's open. Steve, Bittenbinder with Seafood Source.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Question I have is, considering what has happened with the spillway being opened twice this year, is that going to lengthen the amount of time that this dead zone really is in play in the Gulf? And is it also, geographically, are you seeing it sort of in the same area, or is it shifting east, west, north, south? Are there any geographical, differences between this year and previous dead zones?
Nancy can take this. The distribution along the Louisiana coast is similar to many other years, from the Delta all the way over to the Texas coast and sometimes onto the Texas coast. What's different this year is with the additional water going to the east, it pretty much stays to the east. And that's why we're seeing the toxic cyanobacterial blooms. And there are areas of low oxygen to the east of the river this year, and probably more documentation of that than other years. But there are no consistently measured data that can say what's happening on the eastern part of the, on the east, to the east. So there was still plenty of water headed west from the Delta to develop this really high, a really large area of low oxygen.
And if I have a quick follow-up, with this, with more going toward the east, is that what has likely impacted the oyster beds there in Mississippi?
That is the reasoning why the governor of Mississippi asked for a disaster area designation, and they don't take the very low salinities at all.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Janet McConaughey with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, I wanted to check on one detail from what you were just saying, and I also wanted to ask, you mentioned the two previous cruises, and I wanted to, if you could elaborate a little bit about what they were looking at and what they found in terms of hypoxia.
Okay. The National Marine Fisheries Service has a groundfish survey every year, starting at Brownsville, Texas, and then working its way north and then across the Gulf of Mexico into Florida. They documented a large area off of Matagorda Bay and Galveston Bay. Their crews did not go shallow enough to document what we usually document, and they did document an area to the east of the river, similar to what we found in 2011 when we did a cruise over there, that hypoxia was developed on that side. The second cruise is the one that went out right before mine, another professor at LSU, looking at different things but also measuring low oxygen. And he did not find low oxygen in areas where I normally find it, meaning that he was probably more affected by Hurricane Barry than we were. And it, and in that short time, it redeveloped in that area.
Okay, and yeah, I wanted to ask about the hypoxic area east of the river that you had.
The National Marine Fisheries data is on the web at something called Hypoxia Watch, and their maps should be on that website, and mm-hmm. it will show where they found some low oxygen, but they did not map the whole area. So where they did map, they found low oxygen. When we worked the area east of the river in 2011, before our normal cruise and then again after, we found low oxygen from, you know, skirting the chandeliers, in that area in a triangle shape and extending at least as far as Mobile Bay.
Are there plans to look further east in the future?
That would depend on funding, and I don't have that in my crystal ball. I didn't even have the size in my crystal ball this year, but. Dave, you want to speak to that?
So this is Steve from NOAA. I think Nancy is correct that we have not historically from my office funded hypoxia monitoring to the east. Depending on the frequency of the development of a hypoxic zone to the east of the Delta, we may consider that in the future. But as I answered in response to an earlier question, we're hopeful that there may be other technologies that are more potentially efficient that would allow us to monitor multiple locations either with near the same budget or with potentially reasonable additional resources. As it is, we have enough to fund Nancy's crews each year in the analysis of that data. We would not have, under current resources, the funding to produce a similar cruise in other locations.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Jenny Howard with the National Geographic. Your line's open.
Hi, this is Jenny Howard here. I just wanted to follow up on Hurricane Barry's role in the measured size this year. You mentioned that it might revert to more hypoxic conditions in a week or so, and I just wanted to understand that better. Could you elaborate on some of the science of that?
Right. The physical situation, physical oceanography, has to be present along with the high rates of oxygen consumption. And the physics is that the pressure water that comes out and mixes with Gulf is less dense and creates an upper layer over a bottom layer of higher salinity. And the oxygen cannot diffuse from the surface to the bottom because of that difference, the difference in the density of those two layers. So a wave will break down that layered system and allow oxygen to be moved from the surface to the bottom. But with continued fresh water, and there's still plenty of phytoplankton in the bottom sediments, once that structure is rebuilt, and it takes between that and the respiration about a week at the water temperatures we have right now to redevelop, and we could see it redeveloped at some of the stations where I knew it was not present the week before. That help?
Yeah, that does. Thank you for elaborating.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Travis Lux with the New Orleans Public Radio. Your line is open.
Yeah. Hi, this is kind of a question about getting the level of the size of the dead zone reduced. So we were talking earlier about how it seems like there's limited resources for states coming together on this, and the whole concerted kind of federal effort is not exactly there, it sounds like. So absent some sort of mass mobilization from states to take on this issue with more resources or something, what can individual people do? And part B of that would be, how much of an impact would individual type changes even make?
So this is Bill. I'm not sure that I have the perfect answers either, but certainly looking at the goal here to find a reduction of nutrients, I think individuals can think it's a large watershed, and so everybody has an impact, although it may not be a large impact, to be able to look at certainly around smaller bodies of water. We look at phosphorus fertilizer on front yards. We certainly look at farm fields and the timing of nitrogen applications, tile drain water, other erosion control mechanisms. So this is made up of a large number of individuals having an impact, but each individual by themselves probably has a small impact when you look at the amount of water coming from, I believe it's 31 states, they end up in the Gulf of Mexico. So it is a lot of folks acting together to be able to have an impact across the system. but each of us has a small impact, and that can be one of the challenges for engagement of everybody involved. But we are seeing more and more folks engaging, thereby, I think, over time, having a bigger impact without an ability for me to say exactly what that contribution of everybody is.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Kathy Halls with the Tennessee Clean Water Network. Your line's open.
Hi there. I am also with the Mississippi River Collaborative. So I wanted to say a couple things here. First, I wanted to speak to the gentleman that was talking about protections under the Clean Water Act. And the Clean Water Act, drinking water was mentioned, but drinking water is regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. The Clean Water Act has two programs that can be used for to combat nonpoint pollution, and that's Section 319, and those are state grants. So each state gets allotted a certain amount of money that they can use to fund nonpoint pollution programs within their state. And the Clean Water for All Coalition is looking right now into whether or not states get far more applications for nonpoint pollution programs than they are able to fund. And if so, then that would be a worthy ask of our legislature if the Clean Water Act already has the structure in it, the Section 319 structure, to fund more of those programs, then that might be a way that we can use the Clean Water Act to address some of this nonpoint pollution. So I wanted to just throw that out there. If anybody wants any more information on Section 319, I'm digging into that a lot. And I'm at Kathy with a K at tcwn.org. Also, I wanted to ask, this question is in relation to accountability. The nutrient reduction strategies that are at the state level, they were charged with coming up with a nutrient reduction strategy for each one of the states. The Hypoxia Task Force's 2015 framework, on page 2, it says all states that are part of the HTF have submitted draft or completed state nutrient reduction strategies. And that was 2015, and I know that all of the states have not finalized nor implemented all of their state nutrient reduction strategies. So if there is no enforcement from the EPA on the states to get those nutrient reduction strategies done, if EPA has no authority, does the Hypoxia Task Force have any authority in pushing those states harder to finalize those nutrient reduction strategies and get them implemented? Sorry I took so long.
First of all, good catch, Kathy, on Safe Drinking Water Act versus Clean Water Act. Appreciate that. Your mention of EPA 319 grants, too, is certainly an important resource. In many locations across the country, address nutrients and other water issues, other issues of concern around water. There's some flexibility in what they approach when they address concerns around 319, but nutrients is one of those primaries. I know that was something that we coordinated with at the Department of Agriculture in Iowa with our state DNR as they looked at nutrient issues through EPA 319s. And in many cases, we have states, our state conservation agencies or NRCS, our Natural Resources Conservation Service, a part of USDA, that does some coordination as well around trying to leverage those $319 dollars. As far as authorities to force states to either come up with a plan or have a plan graded or talk about the completion, there's not authority specifically within the Hypoxia Task Force to do that. Congress hasn't charged the task force with doing that, and EPA doesn't either have the authority themselves or exercise that through the task force. It really is about bringing folks together to encourage that to happen, to show each other how plans can be developed and what the resources are to put those into place. I think I'm under the impression now that every state does have a plan. Certainly, you're right, not every state has completed the goals that they have in that plan, but I'm pretty sure that every state has a nutrient reduction strategy themselves that they are implementing. Probably nobody has completed their strategy, but they have a strategy that to some degree they're in the process of implementing.
Thank you. And I think at this point, we're going to do last call for questions. If you do have a burning question, please press star one. Give it a couple seconds.
Brady, if I may.
Oh, yeah.
Concerning the last, this is Steve Thur from NOAA. Concerning the last question, the EPA on behalf of the full task force did produce a report in May 2018. It is on the EPA's Hypoxia Task Force website. It is a report on non-point source progress in the Hypoxia Task Force states. So it is a progress report on states' implementation of their individual plans. It is approximately 1 year old, produced in May of 2018.
Thank you. All right, and I don't see any further questions. So at this point, we will conclude the call, and I will remind you that within about an hour or so, audio recording of this call can be found on the NOAA Media Advisory on NOAA.gov. Look for Media Advisories. And if you have further questions or need follow-up, please feel free to email me. That's Brady, B-R-A-D-Y, dot Phillips, P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S. At NOAA.gov, or my colleague Jerry Slaff, which is J-E-R-R-Y dot S-L-A-F-F at NOAA.gov. And I'd like to thank Drs. Rabelais and Thur and Undersecretary Northey for their participation, and have a good day. Thank you. Bye.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.